needed to drive today. I know this is undrivable and what we deserve to score as a result. So we move from there, but this was a terrible race.
Yeah, no worries, Toto. Just keep working hard.
Yeah, we will come out of this.
If you were out driving somewhere and you suddenly got a deeply apologetic call from the people who built the car you were currently sitting in, you'd be pretty freaked out, I would imagine. But for Formula One driver Lewis Hamilton, arguably the greatest driver of all time, that exact thing happened on television at the most recent F1 race in Italy last month. And it is just the latest turn in a shocking season. So today, we catch you up on a sport that is pretty much nothing like it used to be, from the top down, as F1 pursues its manifest destiny and takes over Miami this weekend. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, May 4th. This is ESPN Daily. Lawrence Edmondson, you are ESPN's F1 editor. You're based in London, and being ESPN's F1 editor feels like a really, really different job these days than when you probably first started doing it. What's it been like for you to do this sort of work?
It's been fantastic. I mean, I've been working at ESPN for over 10 years now. And when I first started, it was very much the odd one out. And it still is the odd one out among sports, really, because it's, you know, so much of an engineering challenge as well as a sport. But now it's all kind of coming around to me. And it turns out the thing that I've been excited about for, well, my whole life, pretty much, everybody else is excited about. You know, we go to the pub here in the UK and they ask you about it. And previously, if I started talking about Formula One, everyone would switch off and, you know, somebody would bring up the latest Arsenal match or Liverpool match or whatever.
Yes.
And now people are asking me the questions. So, yeah, especially after the end of last year, it really, I just saw the uptick in interest everywhere, you know, among my friends, among my family, everywhere and within the company. So it's been good.
Yeah, look, the ESPN TV ratings are skyrocketing. Netflix obviously has this Drive to Survive reality show, which has infused all sorts of soap opera into this entire enterprise. But you mentioned the thing that people at pubs are very likely to ask you about, and I will just follow up about that same subject here with you now, because we last had you on to talk about how the season finale went in F1, and it was a jaw-dropper. There was a crash with Verstappen late in the race that led to a last lap nail biter.
Into turn 9, Verstappen stays ahead of Lewis Hamilton. Of all the drama, of all the controversy, of all the magic moments in Formula One in 2021, it comes down to this. And at this moment, it looks like it's going to go the way of Max Verstappen.
Mercedes. And a lot of people felt, Lawrence, that Lewis Hamilton, the 7-time world champion, did not get a fair shake.
No.
Catch us up here. How did that play out in the weeks and months after that?
Well, it took nearly 4 months, really, for people to move on from it. It really took the start of the new season for people to shift perspective from that race to what was coming up. And the reason for that is because a lot of people really did feel, and still do feel, that Lewis Hamilton should have won that title. And it wasn't Max Verstappen's fault, without going into too much detail. It was the race director who had set up the final lap and had created it in a way where Max Verstappen went and won. And, you know, even Lewis, for months afterwards, we weren't quite sure if he was going to continue in Formula One. You know, we know that he's getting towards the end of his career, but his Mercedes team was starting to drop hints that actually maybe he was so upset with what happened that he could just walk away from it.
We'd know for some time that George would be sitting here, but we can't ignore the fact that we weren't sure whether you would be. Obviously, everything that happened in Abu Dhabi, and then you were rightly very private after that. How do you feel, and how have you managed to sort of refocus, given everything that's gone on?
Well, I never ever said that was going to stop.
Yeah, but you scared us all. Let's be honest.
I love doing what I do.
So in the end, the race director, the controversial race director, Mr. Michael Massey, was moved aside, and they brought in new race directors, and they basically said that it was a mistake down to human error, and so there was some admission that something had gone wrong, but without saying the result was the wrong result.
Yeah, it was a sort of a glorious mess. I mean, if you had no stake in this, but just enjoyed seeing some level of dysfunction and high-end athletes just sort of all being mixed in together in some sort of stew, Lawrence, it was delicious. And I'm curious, how would you even describe how his off-season went? How would you describe how Lewis Hamilton had been looking heading into this season?
Well, he went very quiet. We didn't hear from him at all. And I think that was a conscious decision, both from him personally, because he was so angry at what had happened that there wasn't a huge amount of point in putting that anger out there and kind of creating issues that weren't necessary. But in the same way, it put extra pressure on the FIA to act and to take this seriously and to launch a full investigation and to come to some kind of conclusion. This is what I think all pro sports people have, is that they do have an ability to move on. You know, the very best will be able to compartmentalize. And going into this year, you know, Lewis, I'm sure, would have felt, I'll just have another go at it this year. The reality is slightly different because the car's not quite there.
Yeah, the car, the mechanical engineering nerdery, Lawrence. I have so many questions about that. We'll get into that in a second here. And for the record here, Lawrence, I love that a quiet offseason also involved Lewis Hamilton being knighted at Windsor Castle.
To receive the honor of knighthood, Sir Lewis Hamilton, for services to motorsport.
Well, that was one event where the cameras had to show up. And I think that was important for him as well. I think it'd been a long time coming. But I think the nicest thing about that was that he took his mum with him. And it was him and his mum posing for the photos. And I've never seen a prouder parent than Lewis's mum stood there next to her son, Sir Lewis Hamilton. That was great to see.
Do your friends give you a hard time? Do you make them call you sir when you all hang out?
No, just my dad. I don't make anybody call me. My niece and nephew call me Sir Uncle.
Sir Uncle?
Yeah. So
that's good.
And it's a huge privilege in the UK, but I don't really notice it too often.
I do want to sort of just zoom out on kind of the planet here, the world of F1, because as we've sort of been discussing, like, there is no sport that has bigger overlap with, like, stuff that James Bond likes than the sport that you love. I mean, people are getting knighted. There are extraordinarily fast luxury car chases, some just excellent top shelf accents. And you spin the globe and yeah, races are happening from Monaco to Mexico City to Singapore to, until recently, Sochi in Russia. And notably there, Lawrence, of course, F1 canceled its contract with Russia with Putin invading Ukraine, and so the 2022 Russian Grand Prix will not be held there, and neither will any future races. What was the reaction to that decision?
Well, I think everyone in the sport agreed with it and realized it was necessary. It happened within days of the invasion, and really there was no way F1 could go racing there, and that was clear from the moment that happened. And the decision was taken fairly quickly. And look, you know, there's not a single person in F1, I think, who disagrees with that. There was a Russian driver as well, Nikita Mazepin, who was due to race this year, but he had his contract ended with Haas and then had sanctions put against him personally. His father, Dmitry Mazepin, was one of the people who was actually in the meeting among high-profile business people the day after the invasion, or the days after the invasion, talking about Russia's next step. So there was no way, really, that Nikita Mazepin could continue in F1 once that invasion happened. It just wasn't possible given the global situation.
And the other question that sort of results logically off of that, Lawrence, is where does F1 stand with Saudi Arabia, right? Because this is another footprint of a global sport. This is a sport that sent drivers to Saudi Arabia in late March. What does that say about the organization's sort of geopolitical philosophy here?
Well, it's an interesting one. I mean, the clear distinction, which I think F1 has pointed to and a lot of people point to, is that there are currently no international sanctions against Saudi Arabia that would prevent a race in the same way that there are in Russia. So that's the clear distinction between the two. But of course, the reality is a lot more complicated than that. So the point that we had the race there at the end of March, and there was a missile attack on a nearby oil facility from Houthi rebels. And, you know, that kind of underlined some of the questions that a lot of people had about whether Formula One should be racing in Saudi Arabia. And so Yes, there were big questions. There still are big questions, but that deal is worth an awful lot of money to Formula One. And I can't see currently that them wanting to pull out of it unless they're forced to do so. And at the moment, it doesn't look like they're going to be forced to do so.
Yeah, it's a story of the trade-offs, the compromise between capitalism and autocracy that is extraordinarily common across world sports right now, Lawrence. And F1, I mean, just to put a finer point on how specifically global and different the way this sport operates is, I mean, we've had races in Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Australia, Italy. How different are all these courses from each other in age and structure and just the visuals that are involved here?
Well, some of them, like the Saudi Arabian one, like the Miami one coming up, are brand new, and they've been constructed in areas where people have decided for really money reasons, that's where they want to go, for financial reasons. And then you have the very old tracks. You have Monaco, for example, which has been hosting races since 1929 around pretty much the same set of streets. A few things have changed, but more or less it's the same layout. And so you have this huge variety. And this is where F1 seems to be a bit of a crossroads, in that down one route, there's a lot of new exciting places that want to have Formula One turn up and are willing to spend a lot of money in some cases, certainly in the Middle East, government money on bringing a race there. And then you have independent circuits, essentially, you know, places like Spa-Francorchamps in Belgium, places like Monza in Italy, Silverstone in Great Britain, the circuits that people like me fell in love with when we were kids, which are really just operating as racetracks. And they can't really compete money-wise, financially, with the governments in the Middle East or elsewhere. And a lot of people are concerned that we may lose some of those traditional tracks purely for financial reasons, which would be a real shame for anyone that loves the sport.
Well, as a traditional, I mean, would you call yourself a traditionalist, Lawrence, an F1 traditionalist then?
I like to think I'm open to new ideas and new places, but yes, there's certain parts of the sport which I would be very upset if we lost.
Yeah, and so what about the old courses, those traditional ones, did you fall in love with that you're now sort of sad about, to just be specific about those characteristics?
Well, a lot of them are very high speed. A lot of them are based on old roads. I mean, for example, Spa was essentially a selection of roads in Belgium that wind around the Ardennes Mountains. And for that very reason, it is a stunning and beautiful track that you probably wouldn't get permission to build nowadays. Then you have places like Suzuka in Japan, which is just a stunning, sweeping set of corners in a figure of eight layout, which you don't get with modern tracks. You know, people just don't build these tracks anymore. And also a lot of these old tracks have a real risk and reward. You know, it's gravel traps there rather than big concrete runoff areas. So if a driver makes a mistake, that's the end of their race. In Monaco, if a driver makes a mistake, they're up against the barriers and it's sometimes the end of their car. I think lots of the new tracks do look to the old tracks and they try and bring about some of what makes it special and kind of manufacture it into new designs, but it's never quite the same.
Yeah, Lawrence, in your voice, I'm already sensing like the person who like is like, look, the CGI in this movie, it's too much of it. We're getting away from the reason we fell in love with this in the first place.
That's absolutely right. It is like that.
And few places challenge how beautiful the artificial can be, quite like the city of Miami, where the newest F1 race is about to happen on Sunday, and that's after the break.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So, Lawrence, I now respect how much you love the old tracks and towns of Formula One, but I also know that you're not complaining about a trip to South Beach, right? I mean, no one does. I miss those days in my life. And what you're about to see down in South Florida is the Crypto.com Miami Grand Prix. And I don't know if you can find a better forward summary of where the sports world is right now than that one, but how did this race even come about?
Well, the original plan was for a race in downtown, and that was meant to be in 2019. So it's been a long, long process. And it really goes back a couple of years before that when Liberty Media took control of the sport and they wanted to expand in the United States, Liberty Media being a US-based company. And they saw huge potential. And so they really wanted races in what they called destination cities. And Miami was one that was interested. And Stephen Ross, who owns the Miami Dolphins, was the man who was going to make it happen from the very start.
Yes.
And so originally, yeah, they looked to make it happen in a downtown track, but there was local opposition. And I think this, again, is the difference between a place like Abu Dhabi, Bahrain, where really the government, whatever the government says, goes in terms of we're going to have a race. You know, this is the way it happens. Whereas you come to a place like the United States and you know what? Not everybody likes motor racing. Not everybody wants cars going around their backyard.
Correct.
And fair enough. The people that do not want the race have tried everything they can to try and stop it happening. And that's included court cases, which were only going on until a week or two ago, with concerns about the hearing of local people. Will it be damaged by the cars going around the track? I can say from my personal experience of these cars, at least modern Formula One cars, it probably won't be. And so F1 hit a number of roadblocks with Miami until they finally got to where they are now, which is in the Hard Rock Stadium, home of the Miami Dolphins. The Stephen Ross link there is obvious, but it's essentially in the car park of that stadium. I also understand those local residents. I mean, if somebody decided they were going to bring a horse race through my part of London and, you know, it meant that I couldn't really step out of my door for crowds, you know, for 3 days solid, I don't know if I'd be that happy about it either.
Yeah, especially if the people who were attending that horse race were as hammered as I imagine the people attending this F1 race would be.
Well, this is the other interesting thing about this race is that it's not really been pitched at your standard motorsport fan. I mean, I know from experience they get as drunk as the next person, but...
Describe the culture, Lawrence, because this is what I am fascinated by too.
So with Miami, what they're pitching to is corporate entertainment, corporate hospitality, really. And if you look at the plans for the track and how it's going to lay out, almost every corner, there's a kind of decking area, either for Red Bull, for McLaren, for Mercedes.
Like luxury suite stuff.
Luxury suite stuff, some beds. In one area, at the inside of Turn 7, they've even created a fake harbour. So they've got these dry dock boats and they've built up a kind of wooden structure around them. And then they're going to put this vinyl over the wood, which looks like water. So from above, it's going to look like these boats in a harbour. In fact, it's just these dry dock boats.
No, just South Beach, always known for its subtlety.
But, you know, if it gets people involved, I mean, McLaren have said they have 1,000 guests coming to this race, which is way more than they would usually have. And they said they could have sold double those tickets if it had been available. So there's this huge interest and they promised it's going to be a race unlike any other. And from what I've seen so far, for better or worse, that is true.
Yeah. South Beach tends to live up to that description and all of the compliments and pejoratives implied. But hold on, because what you're describing here is obviously a business strategy. And so the manifest destiny of F1 as the United States is concerned, I'm curious about it, Lawrence, because we have the Austin race already. We have Miami now. The series expands to Las Vegas next year, right? So what is behind this acceleration? What do you see happening here?
Well, there's no doubt about it that the United States is an incredibly big and lucrative market. And that's exactly the reason that F1's targeted it. And they've actually done it in a very structured and careful way over the last few years. And we weren't initially aware of some of the stuff they were doing, but perhaps the masterstroke was Drive to Survive.
Formula One is brutal. It can get tough. It can get ugly.
What a race! Amazing!
You can be the hero today, but forgotten tomorrow.
Everybody's different, but the best ones can step up.
that series on Netflix has just boomed popularity all around the world, but especially in the United States. It is undoubtedly an exaggeration of reality. But that's not to say there aren't elements of truth. And you know what's nice about it is that for a long time, if you were working in Formula One, you saw all these characters. For example, Günther Steiner, he's the team principal at Haas. He's the team boss there. And we all knew he was a great character. We used to go to his media sessions and he'd crack jokes and drop swear words and all this kind of stuff.
He smashed my f***ing office door.
Where is he?
I don't know where he is, but he can f*** off, I told him, both of them.
We've got two f***ing idiots driving for us.
And then all of a sudden that came across in Drive to Survive and he became this big star out of it. And otherwise, a team like Haas, which is either at the back of the grid or they're doing a little bit better this year, but they're never right at the front. For a team like that to get that kind of exposure is a big deal.
How would you describe how they tried to sell F1 to Americans before versus how it's being sold today? Because obviously the pitch back then when you were growing up wasn't terribly successful at all, but now it's obviously extraordinary.
In the old days, I think it was, here's your race, take it or leave it. If you're interested, come along. If you're not, so what? And this was the thing about F1's business model back then. It was all about, and it still is, about race hosting fees. So as long as there was somebody in the United States who was willing to pay F1 for the race to turn up, that's all really F1 cared about. They would take the money and they would go back to Europe the next week, and that would be it. Things really hit a low point in 2005 when the Michelin supplier teams had problems with their tires and they couldn't go around Indianapolis without the tire exploding.
So it looks like we're going to have a six-car start. Six cars.
So we ended up with a race with just six cars.
Who knows what's going to happen in the US Grand Prix? It's the strangest race ever, and it gets underway now.
F1 could have found ways around it, yet they didn't. They just let it go ahead, and they let a race happen with six cars. And understandably, the fans who were paid to turn up at Indianapolis were furious.
I don't know what it says about the six teams that have elected to run, to be honest. Maybe they're contractually bound, but they should have joined up and found the solution too. I think they're probably just as guilty here of doing the wrong things as the guys in the pit.
Prior to Liberty Media, the sport was run by a guy called Bernie Eccleston. You may have heard about him. He was a big deal within motor racing circles, and he was the guy who basically turned the sport into what it was. He took it from a fairly amateurist competition into this big professional money-making machine. And so when it was sold on, not directly from Bernie, but from a group called CVC Capital to Liberty Media, the big question was, what happens next? How do you evolve it beyond Bernie? And they decided pretty much straight away they would sideline him. They decided that it wasn't essential to get immediate returns on promoting the sport. You could go for a longer game. You could invest in social media, for example, which had no real monetary return within the space of a year or two.
No.
But when Liberty first took over Formula One, I remember a colleague of mine writing an article about the sport, and Formula One's Facebook page had less followers than not the World Cup page, but the page for the football in the World Cup. It had its own page. And
the soccer ball.
The soccer ball had more followers than Formula One, which just showed you how much it had been neglected. YouTube presence just didn't exist. Stuff which is almost unimaginable now for a global sport just wasn't there. So there was some really low-hanging fruit. And ultimately, that's what they built around. And I think always with a view to increasing a presence in the United States, both in terms of races and fans and creating a buzz around it, getting other sports to talk about it.
So again, Lawrence, as is obvious to you, I am a deep casual when it comes to F1. And I look at the standings and Lewis Hamilton is there in seventh, entering Miami. And that's jarring to me, given that I only know him as many people's GOAT. So what's going on? Like, is this just the new normal now?
Well, not only is he seventh in the standings, he said twice at the last race that his championship chances are over. So he's ruling himself out of winning a title this year.
When he said that, were you surprised to hear him be that blunt?
I wasn't, because I can see exactly why he says it. And the reason he says it is that the car that Mercedes have built under this new set of regulations for this year, isn't quick enough. It isn't a match for Red Bull and Ferrari. And this is the thing that is perhaps hard to understand about Formula One, is that it looks so much like an individual pursuit. It looks a bit like tennis, for example, where it all comes down to that individual. And for so long, we see people dominate the game. Yet in Formula One, you're so reliant on the car. It's a team sport. The engineers that work behind the scenes, the ones that work at the factory, the ones that then work at the track to get it to work properly, the mechanics that put the car together. As soon as there's a problem somewhere along those lines, the driver can't do much about it. Mm. And this is the big thing that Lewis is facing, is that this year's Mercedes has a fundamental issue, which they're still hopeful they can cure. But if they can't, then it's just not going to be able to compete with Ferrari and Red Bull. And Lewis isn't going to be able to win the championship.
But wait, what is this? Again, I grew up in Manhattan in New York City. I don't own a car. I could be conned by even the worst auto mechanic. But can you try your hand at explaining what is wrong and how surprising it is that this aspect of the Mercedes car is so awful?
Right, here goes. So the new generation of Formula One cars, essentially, they operate like an upside down aeroplane wing. So when you're in a plane, you look out at the wings and they're generating lift. And the way they're profiled is to generate lift so that the plane takes off. A Formula One car is working in exactly the opposite way. It's using the air, but to do the opposite thing, to stick the car to the ground, to create what we call downforce, which gives the driver more grip as they go around the corners, which allows them to go faster around the corners. The only issue Mercedes faces is that the way that airflow is moving underneath the car, which is where a lot of the downforce is created, it's stalling. And it's stalling momentarily. And that's making the car bounce up and down. And as the car bounces up and down, it becomes incredibly difficult to drive. Now, lots of the cars, because of this new regulation set, are suffering from this bouncing. But the problem for the Mercedes team is that not only is it bouncing when it's at high speed on the straights, it's doing it in the corners. And as soon as you start doing it in the corners, you really can't compete. And the thing about new regulations is that you can't see what anyone else is doing. They're all in their factories working away on their individual concepts. And they've all got these ideas in their head. And they've probably explored some of the other ideas. They've maybe even heard from other engineers what's going on at other teams. But the reason you're following your concept is because you believe it's the right one.
Wait, so there's kind of like a science fair dynamic after regulations are implemented because everyone shows up and it's time to test out the thing that you built.
That's a great way of putting it. Exactly. So the covers come off, and quite literally the covers do come off in what we call the launch season of the cars, where they whip the covers off and we see what's underneath. And the Mercedes, it became clear from the second test, so they're allowed to test the cars before they race them. The second test, it became clear that Mercedes had gone quite a different way in terms of their concept. Their science fair project was very different to Ferrari's and Red Bull's. And we all thought, well, these guys are the world champions.
Right. They're Mercedes, Lawrence. I don't know much about cars. I know Mercedes is an empire unto itself.
Yeah. And Lewis even said, somebody said to him, well, are you not worried that maybe your team's got it wrong? And he said,
my team don't make mistakes. So
it turns out with this, they have made a mistake. And he actually addressed that quote in Italy.
When you see Max unlapping you, I know it's a different, it doesn't matter who's lapping you, it's never a good feeling, but does that kind of show you how far you guys have changed over time?
Just shows how wrong we got it.
Toto Wolff, the team principal at Mercedes, apologised to Lewis Hamilton over the team radio for the car he had to drive in Italy.
Lewis, hi. Sorry for what you have needed to drive today. I know this is undrivable and not what we deserve to score as a result. So we'll move from there, but this was a terrible race.
Yeah, no worries, Toto.
This bouncing, they just didn't see in any of their simulations. And if they understand that, then they can bring new parts to the car and develop it and hopefully stop it from doing that. And then also, by the time Mercedes solve their problems, will they be so far behind that they can't catch up anyway? Those are the questions Mercedes face.
Yeah, it's never great, Lawrence, when you're trying to fix the plane while you're also flying it, in other words. But as for the people, the drivers who Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes are now watching fly past them, I want to get to them after one more quick pit stop ourselves.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine. Especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So with Mercedes and Lewis Hamilton struggling this badly, Lawrence, there is a power vacuum. And so who is stepping into that? Who is making a run for the championship this season?
So we've seen a few teams show up, which maybe we wouldn't expect to have shown up at the front of the grid this year. So the Haas team, the American team, has made a big step. They were always last year right at the back, and they've put themselves in the middle. Alfa Romeo, another team that was at the back, have put themselves in the middle. But you know what? It's still the big kids with the big pocket money that continue to be right at the front, because ultimately they're the ones with the facilities. So we're talking Red Bull and Ferrari. And I'm sure once Mercedes get their head around these new regulations, they will return to the front. Also, I think engineers are always a bit careful about that, because you're probably one brilliant idea away from being right at the front or right at the back. You know, they're always on the edge with these ideas, with these concepts. So I think whilst a number of teams will be a bit smug about what's happened, a number of drivers will be very happy to be finishing ahead of Lewis Hamilton this year when they weren't expecting to at the start of the year. There's always that element of caution, because you know that the following year or by the end of this year, Mercedes could be right back up there and it could be them further back. And pretty much all those teams have been through that experience before.
Yeah, so how would you describe what the sports pecking order looks like right now, Lawrence, versus expectations that you would have had entering this year? Obviously, Lewis Hamilton is struggling, but in terms of like the younger, newer names that people may not be as familiar with, what are you seeing out of them and why? Why is it this way?
Well, it's really good, actually. It's really good news for F1, because you've got Max Verstappen, the reigning champion. We saw him go up against Lewis Hamilton. We talked about that as the battle of generations, the Lewis Hamilton generation versus the Max Verstappen generation. Well, the Max Verstappen generation won out. Controversially, I know, but it won out. And now another driver from his generation, Charles Leclerc, who drives for Ferrari, has a car capable of fighting Max.
Here comes Verstappen again. He's almost pushed onto the grass. Somehow Leclerc stayed ahead. And I think Verstappen had to back off a little bit there, because he was almost on the grass on the inside at Stowe. This is getting serious.
What's really interesting about that is that their relationship, competitive and off the track, goes back years to when they were in go-karts together, when they were kind of 11, 12 years old. And so there's a lot of history there. And Charles Leclerc said recently that back then they hated each other. And he uses the word hate. But now they're on slightly more friendly terms. But we'll see how long that lasts, because every championship, close championship, has the same dynamic. They start off and they joke about things and they talk about the past and all this kind of stuff. But when it starts to get tense, when it starts to get close towards the end of the season and every result really, really matters, that's when you start to see these rivalries explode. And so there's always a danger with Formula One that you get one team that dominates, but at least in this instance, we've got two teams and two very good drivers who we know from the past very evenly matched, and we know from the past there's a bit of needle there that perhaps will spark into something really quite exciting by the end of the year.
Where are you going next? I mean, you got Miami, and then where does your job take you?
Well, it's non-stop this year. So after Miami, it's Spain. And then the week after that, it's Monaco, which anyone who's not familiar with Formula One but wants a taste of what the old school Formula One is all about, tune into Monaco. And it's always the most exciting race, but it is spectacular to see on TV, and it's spectacular when you're there. So Monaco's up next. And then, you know what? It's 1 week off, 2 weeks on, 1 week off, 2 weeks on. We go around Europe. There's a trip to Canada, to Azerbaijan. There's then trips out to the Far East. We've got Singapore, Japan, back to the Middle East for the finale in Abu Dhabi again. It really is nonstop. 23 races planned this year.
Man.
It's becoming quite difficult, actually, to travel around and follow. Not complaining, but it does. It takes its toll.
Yeah, Edmondson, Lawrence Edmondson. Thank you for trotting the globe and coming back to join us.
Hey, no problem. Thank you, Pablo.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.